Last week, we talked about the struggles of Jacob, and we talked about the story, particularly about Jacob wrestling with God and what that looked like and what that means for us. And you know, are we able to wrestle with God, and how do we wrestle with God? What does that look like? And this week, we're kind of looking at perspective of Joseph. How did Joseph view life, given all his circumstances in life? How did he view it? And it's my conviction that just as God enabled Jacob to wrestle with him, God enabled Joseph to have a right perspective on life. And I think part of the reason why his story is in here is to help us gain a better perspective on life. When everything is going on around us, when all seems lost or crazy or chaotic or just unknown, it's very helpful to have a right biblical perspective on things. Now, the word perspective means to look through. And so it's normally related to how we look on life, how we view the world around us, right? And so sometimes we are split into two camps. Either you're pessimistic, you know, things are always going to go wrong, or you're optimistic. Everything is just a bright, sunshiny day, right? Either the glass is half full or it's half empty, you know? Either the bowl of candy is half full or half empty or whatever, right? How we approach good and bad circumstances in life is heavily influenced then by our perspective, right? So if our perspective is wrong, if it's off, if it's tainted, then everything else, I think, is going to be tainted. Now, while I think personal experiences in our culture can help influence our perspective, I think an even bigger influencer is our belief system. Namely, what do we believe about ourselves, right? I think as Christians, maybe an even bigger question or more prominent question to ask is, what do we believe about God? I've used this quote by A.W. Tozer a lot of times, but I really think it is true. He says, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. Because here's the thing. Our view of God influences our view of ourself. And both of those, I believe, kind of like shape our perspective in life and the circumstances around us. If we have a warped view of God, that he is an enemy or he is against us or whatever, right? Our view of ourself is, I'm all alone in this world. It's up to me to survive. And I have to do whatever it takes in order to survive. And so then I'm looking at the world and all the circumstances in this survival mode, right? And bad choices are being made in that type of mode. But if I believe that God is not my enemy, but rather a good father, and therefore I am his child through Christ, then I'm looking at things differently in the world, and I say, well, yeah, that's bad that that's happened, but I know my father is going to get me through it. He's not going to leave me to fend for myself. I don't have to be in this survival mode at all. I can rest and trust that someone bigger than me is handling the situation. Does that make sense? Okay. So 1 John 4:4 says, greater is he who is in me than who is in this world. Let's add to that. Greater is he who is in us than those things which surround us. Greater is he who is in us than those things which come against us. Greater is he in us than those things which keep us up at night, which bind us hopelessly, which tempt us and trip us up all throughout the day. Greater is he, greater is God who is in us than anything else that tries to consume or have dominion over our life. Paul says it kind of this way in Romans 8. He says, if God is for us, then who or what can be against us? We know that God works in all things for the good of those who love him, for those who are called according to his purpose. Our God is sovereign, working for our good and working to bring about his glory. And here's the truth. He will not fail in fulfilling these things. God will not fail in being sovereign. He will not fail in working for our good. He will not fail in bringing about his glory. So in this, we hope. And by this, I'm making the argument today, by this, our perspective in life should be shaped. That God is sovereign, that he's working for our good, and he's working to bring about his glory. So let's look at the life of Joseph and try to understand his perspective on life. So, the next patriarch in Genesis that we kind of look at is this guy named Joseph, right? Now, remember, in Genesis 1 through 11, the focus is global, right? Moses is writing about humanity as a whole. And then in Genesis 12 through 50, the focus becomes local, a particular family line that is chosen by God, right? And so within this family line, Moses talks about four patriarchs. Abraham, who we talked about, Isaac, which we kind of talked about, and then Jacob, we talked about last week, and then the next patriarch is Joseph, who we talk about today. And Joseph is the first son of Jacob and Rachel, but he's Jacob's 11th child. In Genesis 37, we're kind of picking up his story when he is about 17 years old. Now, because Joseph is Jacob's favorite, Jacob gives his son a coat of many colors. In fact, I think if everyone knows that, right? Like, you know, when you ask people about Joseph, they're immediately like, oh, the guy with the multicolored jacket, right? Yeah. That guy, right? Here's the thing about this jacket is that this jacket basically displayed Jacob's favoritism towards his kids, right? And so basically what Jacob was doing by giving Joseph this jacket was kind of raising him above and saying, this is my number one son. This is my favorite, right? Because he's adorned with this beautiful jacket, okay? That immediately starts causing division between all the brothers, and hate begins to build up within them, especially the older ones, right? Because, like, so Jacob or Joseph is number 11, so there's, you know, 10 more brothers ahead of him. They're all like, dude, I was here first. Why is the little guy, you know, getting all the attention? All right? So it starts all this division in them. And we also see that God's hand is already upon Joseph because the Lord speaks to him through two specific dreams. And basically the dreams are that Joseph is in this prominent position and all of his brothers come and bow down before them. Or before him, kind of like in this, like, he is superior than they are. Well, of course, when you tell your older brothers this, they're going to, you know, want to beat you up and kill you and all that, right? Because they're like, dude, again, we're older than you. Respect us, you know? And so that just fuels the hatred inside the brothers even more. And yet, already, God is working and bringing about a situation that will not come to fulfillment until a couple decades later. One day, Jacob sends Joseph to check on his brothers who were out with their flocks. I forgot my little pointer up here. If you look on the map on this side, the dashed line is kind of the route Joseph probably took all the way up to Dothan, okay? And he goes looking for his brothers, and as he approaches them, they start devising a plan of how can we get rid of this guy? We're bringing him out into the middle of nowhere. No one's around. It's desert out here, easily to hide a body. How do we hide the body, right? So they determine to throw him into a pit. A bit later, Judah, one of Joseph's older brothers, sees a caravan of Ishmaelites, okay, and convinces his other brothers to sell Joseph as a slave. This way, that they just sell him, they don't really have to be responsible for what happens to him. So if they kill him, well, it's on them. It's not on the brothers, right? They get off scot-free. And so then, there you go. So then this route here is kind of the way that they believe that the Ishmaelites carried Joseph off down to Egypt. And so that line is, again, up here, which is one of the main roads and trading spots in that area and going into Egypt. Now, here's the thing about Judah. Judah had some personal motivation for getting rid of Joseph. So remember, typically, the older son would receive the birthright and the covenant promise from God. Well, the older son would be Reuben in this case, and Reuben forfeited his birthright because he, we're told, he actually slept with Jacob's female servant, Bilhah. And so he lost the right to be the first son and to receive the birthright. And then Simeon and Levi, the next two brothers, they forfeited their chance of the birthright because they savagely killed the men of Shechem, the men who defiled their sister. And so they both lost the birthright. And so the next son in line would be Judah. Well, here's Dad raising up Joseph as the favorite. And here's Joseph coming in saying, you know, all these dreams of brothers bowing down. And so the perception Judah has is he's in survival mode. How do I keep a hold of what I think rightly belongs to me? I need to get rid of my opposition. I need to protect myself. I need to protect my birthright, right? So his whole motivation in this is get Joseph out of the way so that way he is able to secure the birthright for himself. So as the Ishmaelites take Joseph to Egypt, they sell him to a guy named Potiphar, who is an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. This is beginning of Genesis 39. As the Lord caused Joseph to be successful in Potiphar's house, Potiphar began favoring Joseph and eventually actually made him the overseer of his house. And this in turn caused the Lord to bless Potiphar's house for the sake of Joseph. So here we kind of see the sovereign hand of God bringing about his glory as he works for the good of Joseph, right? Potiphar is seeing God working in Joseph's life. He's like, you're different. Things are different about you. And Joseph saw God working in his life, and even in the midst of a foreign land. So in this, we should understand that in whatever circumstance the Lord brings us into, either through his own doing or our own doing, God always goes with you. God did not stay up in Canaan. God traveled down with Joseph into Egypt, into the foreign land, into the enemy territory. He does not leave you alone. And though you may feel his presence has gone, our God is there nonetheless. Here's something I had to learn early on in my Christian walk, is that God is more than feeling. If all God is to you is a feeling, he is a very unfaithful God, because our feelings are very unfaithful. They're very fleeting, in fact. God is more than a feeling. He is a reality, I think, to be experienced and embraced. Another thing is that the Lord desires for others to experience his blessing and presence through you. God wanted to reveal himself to Potiphar. Now, whether or not Potiphar became a believer in the one true God, we don't know. But still, God wanted to reveal himself to Potiphar, and he wanted to do it through the work and attitude and perspective of Joseph. And so if Joseph was being faithful in doing that, God was faithfully helping Joseph, right? And blessing Joseph as a result of that. As God reveals himself in the midst of our circumstance, he's looking to reveal himself to those in the situation with us. Now, as time goes on, there comes a time when Joseph has a really, really bad day. What's that about? The horrible, no good, bad? Some children's book. Anyway, Joseph has a really bad day, right? Apparently, Potiphar's wife really thought Joseph was good looking, and she kept wanting to sleep with him, and he kept saying no. Well, one day she sets a trap for him, and by God's grace, he escapes that trap. Because, and this is interesting, because he tells her, how can I do this against my master? More, how can I do this against my God? God has been blessing me all this time. How can I turn my back on that? How can I throw that aside? How can I not recognize that? Joseph ends up finding himself being wrongfully accused and thrown into prison because he wouldn't sleep with the wife. The wife goes to Potiphar, her husband, and says, hey, that Hebrew you brought, he tried to sleep with me, and I brushed him off. I got him out of here, and he left, and here's his garment. And Potiphar, without thinking, just immediately takes Joseph and throws him into prison, and so that's where he's at. As a slave in a foreign land, he has absolutely no rights at all. So Joseph faces injustice and betrayal once again, first by his brothers and now by his boss. Now, at this point, would we not understand if Joseph turned his back on God? Would we not understand if Joseph started planning a savage revenge on those who had thus far done him harm? Is this not what our culture often conveys? Someone wronged you, go wrong them back. Go sue them. Go take them for everything they're worth, right? Is this not what some of us do ourselves, maybe openly or secretly? How can I get back at them? How can I show them just It's interesting that the world, the two passages that the world often quotes back to the church pretty verbatim is, judge not lest thee be judged, and an eye for an eye. And both of those passages do they use incorrectly, right? But that's just the mindset, right? And sometimes that's our mindset. Instead, what we find in Joseph's response should be found in our own response when faced with injustice by others. See, Joseph is sustained in prison, in the midst of prison, by God's steadfast love and faithful presence, which provides Joseph the means to endure the circumstances around him. See, in the midst of an uncontrollable situation, Joseph holds fast to the truth that God is in control. That's what we mean by when we say he is sovereign. God is in absolute control. And God is working all things for Joseph's good. Now, here's the thing. You don't have to fully understand that. I'm sure Joseph sitting in this prison was like, I don't see how this is possible. This isn't good. This isn't for my good, right? He's unjustly in a prison. We don't have to fully understand it. It's just that we say, I don't understand it. I don't know what you're doing, God. But I believe deep down that you are working, that you're not asleep. You haven't abandoned me. You are in this. And you're going to get me through this. After a few years pass, the Pharaoh of Egypt has some weird dreams which no one could interpret. Now, there was a servant of Pharaoh's inside this prison beforehand with Joseph. And he remembers, when I had some dreams and I couldn't figure them out, this guy that was in prison with me, well, he interpreted my dreams and it came true. So Pharaoh, maybe this guy could do the same thing for you. And so Pharaoh has Joseph come out of the pit and shave him and you know, clean them all up. Because back then, Egyptians were not hairy at all. They were shaving clean. Right? So they clean him up, they bring him before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh begins talking about his dreams again. And as Joseph begins interpreting his dreams, he assures Pharaoh, look, the one who's giving this interpretation is the one true God. The one who's going to bring about fulfillment of these dreams is the one true God. Again, God is trying to reveal himself to Pharaoh, and God is using Joseph to do this. And as he begins interpreting these dreams, it's revealed that there's going to be a famine. There's going to be 7 years of plenty, and then there's going to be 7 years of famine. And because famine is coming, Egypt needs to prepare. And here's the thing that Joseph tells Pharaoh, that the one true God has fixed this famine. There's nothing you can do to change it. You can't call on your gods. You can't try to manipulate. You can't try to change this. God has set into motion already that this famine is coming. So you got to prepare for it. And if God is the one that is causing it, then we should also know that God is the one that will provide survival. Right? Because here's the thing, he cares about these people as well. And I think I lost my train of thought. As God brings about this survival and begins talking to, and Joseph is conveying this to Pharaoh. He's doing so through the wisdom imparted by God's Holy Spirit that is inside of him. And I think that things begin clicking for Joseph. He begins finally understanding why things have happened in his life thus far. Right? Because he realizes, okay, so for God to work through this, he's going to need a willing vessel to work through. He's going to need someone who is able to do this, who has the faith to do this. And he begins understanding and realizing, so this is why my brothers sold me into slavery. This is why in Potiphar's house I was put into prison and wrongfully accused. This is why I was given the means to interpret dreams. This is why. Everything is making sense. Have you ever had that experience happen to you? When you're all of a sudden sitting there in the midst of a circumstance and all of a sudden you realize, oh my goodness, it all makes sense now. Like, this is why this happened. This is why that happened. And this is why I'm here right now. It wasn't just because of a coincidence. There is no coincidences at all. It's all God working through things and bringing it about. And it's his Spirit revealing to you, hey, this is why this has happened. So I can bring you to this point. Because of his interpretations, Joseph rises to power and is now second in command. And so, before the famine takes place, 7 years of plenty happen, food is being stored up in Egypt, and then 7 years of famine begins to take place. And Egypt now has enough food for themselves as well as for all the other nations around because the famine has spread out through that as well. 2 years into the famine, guess who shows up for food? Joseph's brothers. And they come before him in a humble posture because they don't recognize that this is Joseph. Rather, they just see the second in command of Egypt standing before them. And so what do? They come in and they prostrate themselves before him and humbly ask for food. And again, we're even told, Joseph begins remembering, that's what my dream was about. See, the dream he had when he was 17 finds fulfillment here. It wasn't about him trying to seek power over his brothers. It was, this is what I'm going to do through you, Joseph. This is how I'm going to work through you. Right? And so, Joseph begins testing his brothers. Now, this exchange may seem like he's trying to get even with them. However, knowing the character of him thus far, I don't think that's what's happening. Instead, I think Joseph, by testing his brothers, is trying to see if they're really changed. Has their character really changed because they're acting really different right now? I've never seen them humbled like this. I've never seen them be gracious and ask for things. They were always so rude and savage before. But here they are, totally different. Well, are they really different? And I think it's also that he's giving them opportunities to be restored and also to understand the beauty of grace. And so, as the story unfolds, Joseph finally reveals himself to his brothers. And as he does so, he does not hold them responsible for their actions, nor does he blame them for everything that has happened to them in Egypt. Joseph does not take on a victim mentality, although it would be easy for him to do so, right? He's been exiled, he's been bullied, he's been lied about, he's been abandoned. Joseph is a victim here, right? But he does not allow being a victim to dictate his life. Instead, Joseph perceives everything through the lens that God is sovereign and that his sovereign control and faithfulness are over Joseph's life. We read this in Genesis 45 and Genesis 50. When Joseph tells his brothers, look, God sent me before you to preserve my life. It was not you who sent me here. You didn't do this. God did it. God caused you to do that, to bring me to this place so that life could be preserved. Later, he says, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? I'm not going to seek retribution on you. That's not my place. As for you, you meant evil against me. Absolutely. But God turned it all for the good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. And so Genesis kind of closes with the family of Jacob residing in this area called Goshen. It's, you can see it on the map, right? Kind of the top fertile part. It was the best of the best of the land there. About 10% of Egypt. And it's here in Goshen that God's able to provide adequate space and time and provision for this family line to grow into a nation, just as he promised Abraham. See, in order to get his people down to Goshen, he had to get Joseph to be sold into slavery, get Joseph to be put into prison, get Joseph to go before Pharaoh and interpret dreams, to cause a worldwide famine in the area so that there would be enough food provided in Egypt so that the people are able to come down. See, when we begin, I heard it once explained this way. Sometimes all we see is a stamp-sized view of our life. Meanwhile, God is working on a huge tapestry of our life. We don't see all that. All we see is that little stamp view of it. Our perspective needs to be enlarged. It needs to be bigger. God is faithful to bring about his promises. God is sovereign, working for our good, and working to bring about his glory. Let me close with just some thoughts. Maybe today you need a renewed perspective on life. Maybe your problems and situations have blocked out the greatness and the majesty of who our God is. As I said from the beginning, our view of God shapes the view of ourselves, and this should greatly shape our perspective in life. So in renewing our perspective, let me just offer three suggestions. First, take time to seek God's perspective. By this I mean, spend time reading God's word. As a church, we've been going through the Bible together through the reading plan and Bible app of Mission 119. If you need to know more about that, you can come see me, or you can even go on to our website underneath discipleship, and all the information is right there. But it's important that we read the word of God. And it's important that we take time to understand and seek God's way through his word. One of the, tomorrow's reading and Tuesday's reading is going to be on Mission 119. It's going to be on Psalm 119. And the guy who does this, some of the teaching on there, Pastor Soper, actually takes time to explain the importance of Bible memorization and Bible reading. If anything, make sure you do tomorrow and Tuesday. Another thing is spend time praying and talking to God about your problems. Talk to him as you talk to any other person. Talk to him. Pray to him. You don't have to get down on your knees and fold your hands and close your eyes in order to talk to God all the time. Talk to him in the car. Talk to him in the shower. Talk to him, right? Tell him your problems. Tell him your issues. Ask him your questions. And then be sure to spend time listening and resting. One of the most famous Bible verses is Psalm 46:10. Be still and know that I am God. How often do we run through that verse without pausing at that comma where it says, be still? Because really, we can't know that he is God unless we're willing to be still and take time to remember, well, that's right, I'm not in charge in my life. He is. Oh, that's right, he's going to get me through that situation. Oh, yeah. Another thing is take time to understand God's perspective. Pain is not the absence of God's presence. Pain is an avenue for which we experience God's presence in a transforming way. Pain hurts, yes, but it's an opportunity for God to shine powerfully through if we would allow him to. Take time to practice God's perspective. Live by faith. Live in hope. Live from abiding. That's how we practice making sure that we are rightly seeing, that we are rightly knowing who God is and who we are in him. We live by faith. We live in hope that this is not the best. There's something much better yet to come. And we live in abiding, meaning we live from Christ. We live in his presence as he lives in us. The scriptures for that are in your bulletin for you. My prayer is that you will be able to see that God is faithfully working in your life because he is sovereign. He's working for your good, and he's working for his glory. And not just in your life, but through your life into the lives of others. Amen.